pleasure to be here today, albeit on the graveyard shift, but I hope Carl and I will put on a good show for you to conclude the conference. I've had a personal interest in climate change dating back to when the Kyoto Protocol was signed in 1997, and I decided to make that a focus of my research. My PhD and most of my research to date has been on North Korea, so I decided to combine these two interests. I also teach a subject called International Politics of Climate Change for undergraduate students at La Trobe University. And so I think that this interest in climate change has led me to look at North Korea in a very unique way and notice things that perhaps other scholars haven't noticed to date, and that's why there hasn't been any research on North Korea and climate change up to this point. So bear that in mind. This is a very new research project. Findings are tentative. So I am very grateful for any feedback, comments or constructive criticisms that you have. So please fire away in the Q&A and also afterwards if you like. Okay, just a quick one. A lot of my observations have come from in-country experience. I've been to the DPRK now 3 times. Once on the day trip to Kaesong in 2008. Last year I went where the red circles are, did the southern half of the country on a trip. And this year, with Emma and Vanessa here, we visited Rason and Chongjin and Chilbosan and got back 3 weeks ago. Now, this is an esoteric topic. It's an interesting topic, but why is it important? Now, consider this. Northeast Asia is a real flashpoint of Sino-US hegemonic competition at the moment, and many speakers have alluded to this through the conference. Consider the Korean Peninsula and the political stability of North Korea as a potential powder keg that could ignite this rivalry into fire. What I'd like you to consider then is that climate change could be the spark that sets this powder keg alight. I hope this comes through in the presentation. Now, what's the UNFCCC? Does everyone know what the UNFCCC is, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change? Well, let me briefly explain it. Every December, you'll see in the media, there's a conference of parties meeting for this treaty, and it gets a lot of media attention. But the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is an international treaty that came out at the Rio Earth Conference in 1992. It's a framework convention, which means it's an international legal instrument of soft law. It's a soft law shell. And the idea of a framework convention is that over time, the parties that ratify it meet every year and add binding hard law commitments that bind the parties. And they negotiate this through the Council of Parties meetings. So the idea is that the UNFCCC hardens into binding emissions reduction commitments and climate adaptation commitments over time. There's different the parties within the UNFCCC are divided into 3 different groups. There's the Annex 1 parties, who are the developed world. Annex 2 parties, which is the developed world plus the post-communist countries or economies in transition, as they were designated in the 90s. And then there's the non-Annex 1 countries, which is the developing world, if you like. And North Korea is a non-Annex 1 party to this, to the UNFCCC, which means they have different commitments under the convention than developed Annex 1 parties. So when I began this project, my initial research question was, how is the DPRK interacting with the UNFCCC? And through my initial research, I noticed a few things. One is that North Korea, although it's ratified the convention and it's ratified the Kyoto Protocol that goes with it, it's essentially disengaged from the negotiating process. It's nominally part of the G77 negotiating bloc. Now, parties within the convention negotiate as blocs, not as individual countries, because when you've got 150 plus signatories to a treaty, it makes negotiation much easier if they negotiate as blocks. However, the North Korean delegations have been very sporadic in attending the Conference of Parties meetings over the years. They've only attended 3 times in the 18 meetings that have taken place.
since the mid-1990s. However, North Korea does take advantage of the capacity-building elements of the Framework Convention through cooperation with UN agencies, and most importantly and excitingly, if you like, at the moment, through the Clean Development Mechanism, which is a component of the Kyoto Protocol. And I'll speak more about that in due course. Now, these are the obligations for parties under the UNFCCC are spelled out in Article 4.1 of the treaty. Now, I'm not going to go through these in any great detail, but this is how I operationalised my first research question. I looked at how North Korea was complying with each of these obligations under Article 4.1 to see what was there, to see what they were doing. And from initial inspection, they were, you could tentatively say that they were complying in each of these articles. Now, also, I'd like to say that this forms the basis of my paper for this conference. But this is part of a larger project, and I do have a journal article submission that's under review at the moment that takes a more holistic view and looks at a further research question, which is this. Why is the DPRK complying with the UNFCCC? And this is a much more interesting question, I think. And I think there's three major lessons to draw from this. And the first major reason that North Korea is complying is to do with climate change mitigation. North Korea is highly vulnerable to climate change impacts. We see in the Korean Peninsula, climate change is having an impact on the East Asian monsoon. So in the summer rains that usually happen with the monsoon, the constant rains that you get over July, over that period, are giving way to more sporadic rain events, but these are more heavy dumping events. So you see a lot of flooding. You see a greater incidence of flooding and a greater intensity of flooding events, and that's predicted to get worse as climate change advances. Now, that's a problem because climate change is regarded as a threat multiplier. So in countries, climate change impacts have the greatest effect, negative effect, in places where the capacities of a location are already weak, where there's already poverty, where there's already economic inequality, where there's energy problems. And North Korea is a case in point here. It's a weak state, particularly if we look at the agricultural system. It's incredibly labour-intensive. Emma talked about in her presentation in the past session about how the scale of organisation required to run North Korean agriculture means that any kind of disruption can have a critical effect in curtailing agricultural production. And so climate change is just that kind of shock that can send a ripple effect through the agricultural productive activities. And when you're a country that's on the food security breadline, that runs a permanent food deficit, this can have catastrophic effects if you get repeated catastrophic natural disaster events, and that's precisely what we expect to see from climate change. Good illustration. If we look back at the arduous March experience of the 1990s, and we see this threat multiplier effect happening, if you like, we saw state weaknesses because energy shortages from the Soviet collapse, states on the brink of failure, and then we get these natural disaster events, the flooding events, and then the drought that happened in the mid-1990s, which had a crippling effect on the national economy. And you can see this is reflected in the greenhouse gas statistics. This is the CO2 equivalent figures. If you look at the 1990 stats compared to the 2007 stats, arduous March period in between, greenhouse gas emissions almost halved in the intervening period because of the effect on the national economy and because of the link between economic production and greenhouse gas emissions. The second reason why North Korea might be complying with the UNFCCC is to do with adaptation and to do with the treaty provides avenues for North Korea to engage in capacity building projects to deal with its problems in agriculture. Now look at one particular example as to do with land management and hillside cultivation. This picture here illustrates some Kim Il-sung era land terracing, hillside terracing. Now this was a disaster because what happens, they're not reinforced like terraces, hillside terraces in other countries. So when you have big rain events, it washes out. All the silt goes into the valleys, clogs up river systems, destroys farmland that's in the valleys below, and then makes the flooding events even worse because there's no trees or vegetation on the hillsides to lock in moisture. So this is a real problem. But today we see there's incentives for people to continue cultivating on hillsides because the collective farms take up all the best farmland in the valleys. So the government turns a blind eye, or encourages even people to cultivate private plots on these hillsides. So I was really shocked last year and this year when I went to the DPRK and saw the scale of hillside cultivation unconsolidated on hillsides. There should be no business people farming on here because the capacity for soil erosion and soil damage is just very extreme. And you can see here evidence of what happens when you cultivate on hillsides. You can see the land subsidence at the bottom there. All right, the final reason why North Korea might be complying with the UNFCCC is because it provides a vehicle for foreign direct investment, particularly into North Korea's energy sector. And this is a country that has great difficulty attracting foreign investment using any other vehicles. So there's three major issues with the energy sector in North Korea. One is an issue of supply, and this is particularly relevant to liquid hydrocarbon fuels. North Korea doesn't have any oil. It has to import a lot. But the climate treaty is more relevant to electricity generation. So a lot of North Korea's electricity generation infrastructure, power plants, etc., are old and outdated. They're coal-fired and they're grossly inefficient. And also transmission is an issue. So even if you updated all the power plants in North Korea straight away, the transmission infrastructure, power lines, etc., if you like, are also greatly inefficient and probably in some cases would be maxed out if you improved the generation capacity. So I talked about the clean development mechanism before. Now the clean development mechanism is part of the Kyoto Protocol, which was negotiated in 1997. This is one of those hard law additions to the UNFCCC. And this is how it works. Companies from the developed world, from Annex 1 countries, can invest in efficient energy efficiency projects in non-Annex 1 countries, so countries like North Korea. And then they, in exchange for doing that, they get carbon credits. So this helps developed countries and companies in those developed countries. They can claim these as emissions reductions to help meet their emissions reduction targets under the treaty. Now in exchange, the non-Annex 1 or developing countries, this FDI comes in and helps to regenerate, get technology transfer, gets direct investment in the energy sector, and helps them to develop a power generation capacity that they otherwise wouldn't have. So it's a deal. Annex 1 countries get emissions reductions, non-Annex 1 countries get new technology and the regeneration of their energy infrastructure. Now, at the time I wrote this, there were six clean development mechanism projects in North Korea related to hydroelectric dams. So these are new dam projects. This isn't one of them, but it's the only dam I saw in North Korea. So hence the photo. There's also other projects related to wind farms. On our trip, we heard about a new wind farm project in Rason, which is not financed by the CDM, but this is the kind of project. Renewable energy projects offer real promise in North Korea because they can be They can be operated on a small scale, so you don't need a great deal of investment money to set them up. And that can provide local level power generation relief in a way that trying to revitalise big power plants would not be cost effective, and you need to bring in a whole lot of investment funds to do that, and it's a lot less practical. So the clean development mechanism is a good vehicle for North Korea to upgrade its energy infrastructure and power generation capacity. Now, why is that important? So here we come to my tentative findings. And the theme of this panel is the environment and state stability in North Korea. So food security, energy security, two things that are pivotal to North Korea's efforts to sustain the regime and to develop the economy. You can't develop an economy if you don't have a reliable energy supply. And that's what North Korea needs. So my tentative argument here is that North Korea's interaction with the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change gives it a vehicle to regenerate its agricultural system and regenerate its energy system and enhance its economic development from there. So I'll leave it at that, and hopefully we can tease this out a bit more with some questions.